The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian Magazine. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. Today's program will start with an article titled The Old Man and the Tree by Johnny Diamond from the January and February 2022 issue of Smithsonian Magazine. Ecologists thought America's primeval forests were gone. Then Bob Leverett proved them wrong and discovered a powerful new tool against climate change. I meet Bob Leverett in a small gravel parking lot at the end of a quiet residential road in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. We are at the Ice Glen Trailhead, half a mile from a Mobile station. Leverett, along with his wife, Monica Jakuk Leverett, is going to show me one of New England's rare pockets of old-growth forest. For most of the 20th century, it was a matter of settled wisdom that the ancient forests of New England had long ago fallen to the axe and saw. How, after all, could such old trees have survived the settlers' endless need for fuel to burn, fields to farm, and timber to build with? Indeed, ramping up at the end of the 17th century, the colonial frontier subsisted on its logging operations stretching from Maine to the Carolinas. But the loggers and settlers missed a few spots over 300 years. Which is why we're at Ice Glen on this hot, humid August day. To enter a forest with Bob Leverett is to submit to a convivial narration of the natural world, defined as much by its tangents as its destinations, by its opportunities for noticing. At 80, Leverett remains nimble, powered by seemingly endless enthusiasm for sharing his experience of the woods with newcomers like me. Born and raised in mountain towns in the southern Appalachians, in a house straddling the state line between Georgia and Tennessee, Leverett served for 12 years as an Air Force engineer, with stints in the Dakotas, Taiwan, and the Pentagon, but he hasn't lost any of his amiable Appalachian twang. And though he's lived the majority of his life in New England, where he worked as an engineering head of a management consulting firm and software developer until he retired in 2007, he comes across like something between an old Southern senator and an itinerant preacher, ready to filibuster or sermonize at a moment's notice. Invariably, the topic of these sermons is the importance of old-growth forest, not only for its serene effect on the human soul or for its biodiversity, but for its vital role in mitigating climate change. As we make our way up the trail, the old-growth evangelist, as Everett is often called, explains that though individual trees in New England have famously escaped the axe, the nearly 400-year-old Endicott pear tree in Danvers, Massachusetts comes to mind. When ecologists discuss old growth, they're talking not about single specimens, but about systems, about uninterrupted ecological cycles over time. These are forests sustained by a myriad sets of biological processes, complex, interconnected systems of perpetual renewal. While there is no universally accepted definition of old growth, the term came into use in the 1970s to describe multi-species forests that have been left alone for at least 150 years. And that's exactly what we're seeing at Ice Glen, so named for the deposits of ice that lived in its deep rocky crevasses well into the summer months. Hemlocks, hundreds of years old, loom over gnarled and thick-trunked sugar maples, as sunlight thickens into shadow through a cascade of microclimates. White pines reach skyward past doomed ash trees and bent-limbed back birch. Striped maples diffuse a chlorophyll green across the forest floor, though leaves the size of lily pads, while yellow birch coils its roots around lichen-covered rock. Long ago fallen, moss-heavy nurse logs return to earth only to reemerge as philodendron and hemlock. Elsewhere, maidenhair, blue cohosh, and sassafras abound, auguries of a nutrient-heavy, fertile forest floor. Walking through woods like these, this kind of hemlock northern hardwood forest that once thrived in the Appalachians from Maine to North Carolina, is an encounter with deep time. Beginning in the early 1980s, Leverett started to notice something on his weekend hikes in the New England forests. Every so often, in hard-to-reach spots, the steep sides of mountains, along the edges of deep gorges, he would encounter a hidden patch of forest that evoked the primeval woods of his childhood, the ancient hemlocks and towering white pines of the Great Smoky Mountains. But the idea that these New England sites were ancient remnant forests flew in the face of orthodox thinking. A lot of people were skeptical. Even forest ecologists at universities had just given up on the idea that there was any old growth in Massachusetts. Says Lee Freelich, director of the University of Minnesota Center for Forest Ecology and a longtime friend of Leverett's. They just didn't know how to recognize certain types of old growth. Nobody in New England could see it. The turning point in Leverett's nascent evangelism was when he went public with his observations in the spring 1988 edition of the magazine The Woodland Steward, with an article about discovering old-growth forests in Massachusetts' Deerfield River gorges. The reaction among forest ecologists was unexpected, at least to Leverett. By Jove, my telephone started ringing off the hook. People I'd never imagined getting to know called and said, "Are you really finding old growth in the Berkshires?" One of these calls was from Tad Zebrick, a Harvard researcher who asked Leverett if he could tag along to look at some of these trees. Leverett invited Zebrick for a hike near the New York-Massachusetts border, not far from the town of Sheffield, Massachusetts. I was pretty comfortable that it was old growth. It's around a waterfall, rather inaccessible to what would have been original lumbering operations, Leverett recalls. Zebrick brought along an increment borer, a specialized extraction tool for making field estimates on the age of a tree based on its rings, and the two tramped along the watershed. I pointed to a tree and I said, "Tad, I think if you core that hemlock, you're going to find out that it's pretty old." And I thought to myself, maybe 300, 330 years old. Leverett is good with a yarn, and he has told this story, his origin story, many times. Well, Tad didn't buy that at all, but he took me up on my offer, and as God is my witness, he did a field count, and it came out to 330 years. My stock went through the roof. Ever the engineer, Leverett had also begun taking meticulous measurements of the height and circumference of old trees. And just a few years after the Woodland Steward article, he came to another startling realization. The height of American tree species for generations had been widely mismeasured by loggers and academics alike. This deep attention to detail, Bob's remarkable capacity for noticing basic facts about the forest that others had overlooked, would fundamentally change our understanding of old forests, including their potential for mitigating the effects of climate change. If the goal is to minimize global warming, climate scientists often stress the importance of afforestation, or planting new forests, and reforestation, or regrowing forests. But there is a third approach to managing existing forests, proforestation, a term coined by climate scientist William Mumau to describe the preservation of older existing forests. Mumau was a lead author of five major reports of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2007. All of these strategies have a role to play. But what Leverett has helped show in the last few years is how much more valuable proforestation is than we first thought. He has provided hard data that older trees accumulate far more carbon later in their life cycles than many had realized. In studying individual eastern white pines over the age of 150, Bob was able to determine that they accumulate 75% of their total carbon after 50 years of age. A pretty important finding when every year counts in our struggle to mitigate the effects of climate change. Simply planting new forests won't do it. As Leverett recalls it, one of his biggest insights came on a summer day in 1990 or 1991. He was measuring a large sugar maple deep in Massachusetts's Mohawk Trail State Forest, about 5 miles south of the Vermont border. Something was badly off with his measurements, which were telling him he'd just discovered the tallest sugar maple in history. Leverett had seen enough big sugar maples in his life to know that this was definitely not the case. The next time he went to measure the tree, Leverett brought along a specialist in timber frame construction named Jack Sobin, who had a surveyor's transit level. Using the transit, they cross-triangulated their positions relative to the tree, the better to account for its lean. And this is when Leverett and Sobin realized something critical. Measuring for height, no one, apparently, not lumberjacks, not foresters, not ecologists, had been allowing for the plain fact that trees grow crooked. Back then, Leverett explains, the standard way to field measure a tree was pretty simple and had been used for decades. You stretch a tape out level with your eye to the trunk of the tree, then take an angle to the top and an angle to the bottom. This is basically treating the tree like it's a telephone pole in a parking lot, with the top vertically over the base, but 99% of trees aren't so conveniently shaped. Leverett would discover over the subsequent years that the same method had led to widespread mismeasurement of numerous tree species. We are standing over the falling remains of that very same sugar maple on a drizzly fall day some 30 years later. That was the mistake I made at first. The top wasn't over the base. I was off by about 30 feet. Over the years, and often in collaboration with ecologist Robert Van Pelt from the University of Washington, Leverett would develop and popularize a better, more accurate way to estimate the height of a tree, which is known as the Sine method and is accurate to within 5 inches. But Leverett's innovations haven't been just about height. He also developed precise ways to approximate trunk, limb, and crown volume. The resulting larger estimates of how much space old trees occupy have contributed to his discoveries about their heightened carbon capture abilities. A recent study Leverett co-authored with Mu Mao and Susan Massino, a professor of applied science at Trinity College in Connecticut, found that individual eastern white pines capture more carbon between 100 and 150 years of age than they do in their first 50 years. That study and others challenged the long-standing assumption that younger, faster-growing forests sequester more carbon than mature forests. The research bolsters the importance of proforestation as the simplest and most effective way to mitigate climate change through forests. Indeed, according to a 2017 study, if we simply left the world's existing forests alone, by the year 2100, they'd have captured enough carbon to offset years' worth of global fossil fuel emissions, up to 120 billion metric tons. As Frelick says, it turns out that really, really old trees can keep putting on a lot of carbon at much older ages than we thought possible. Bob was really instrumental in establishing that, particularly for species like white pine and hemlock and sugar maple in New England. Over the decades, Leverett's work has made him a legend among big tree hunters, those self-identified seekers who spent their weekends in search of the tallest, oldest trees east of the Mississippi. Big tree hunters are more like British train spotters than gun-toting outdoorsmen. They meticulously measure and record data, the height of a hemlock, the breadth of an elm, for inclusion in an open database maintained by the Native Tree Society, co-founded by Leverett. The goal, of course, is to find the biggest tree of a given species. As with any amateur pursuit, there's disagreement as to standards and protocols, but the one thing everybody seems to agree on is that when you have a lead on the biggest or the oldest, you call Leverett, who is always ready to talk big trees and will often travel to larger specimens to measure them himself. But Leverett's ready acceptance by the community of tree lovers, many of them amateurs, wasn't necessarily reflected in the professional forestry community, which can feel like a tangle of competing interests from forest managers to ecology PhDs. It was going to take more than a single visit to some 300-year-old hemlocks to convince them of old growth in the Northeast, so ingrained were assumptions of its disappearance. So Leverett set about to change that. In the early 1990s, he wrote a series of articles for the quarterly journal Wild Earth to help spread his ideas about old growth among the grassroots environmentalist community. It was Wild Earth co-founder John Davis who first dubbed Leverett the old growth evangelist. In 1993, Leverett co-founded the Ancient Eastern Forest Conference Series, which brought forest professionals together with ecologists from some of the most prestigious academic departments in the country. His work at the conference series led to the publication of Eastern Old Growth Forests, Prospect for Rediscovery and Recovery, an essay collection edited by Mary Bird Davis, for which Leverett wrote the introduction. And he co-authored the Sierra Club Guide to Ancient Forests of the Northeast with the late forest ecologist Bruce Kirshner in 2004. Since then, Leverett has led thousands of people on tours of old growth forest under the aegis of groups like the Massachusetts Audubon Society, the Sierra Club, and the Hitchcock Center for the Environment, and published scores of essays and articles from philosophical meditations on the spiritual importance of old growth forest to more academic work. Leverett is also set to lead a workshop on tree measurement this May at Harvard Forest, the university's forest ecology outpost in central Massachusetts, for scientists, forest managers, and naturalists. Leverett literally wrote the book on how to measure a tree, American Forest Champion Trees Measuring Guidelines Handbook, co-authored with Dan Bertolette, a veteran of the U.S. Forest Service. Leverett's evangelism has had a tangible impact on the preservation of old growth in his adopted home state of Massachusetts. As a prominent figure in a loose coalition of groups, the Massachusetts Forest Trust, the Native Tree Society, the Forest Stewards Guild, Friends of the Mohawk Trail State Forest, dedicated to the identification and preservation of old growth forest, Leverett's work has prompted the Commonwealth to add 1,200 acres of old growth to its forest reserves. At the heart of Leverett's quest lies a simple message that continues to appeal to the scientist and spiritualist alike. We have a duty to protect old growth forest for both its beauty and its importance to the planet. Back in Mohawk Trail State Forest, after paying our respects to the decaying remains of the mismeasured sugar maple, we tack gingerly downward through a boulder field from fairy tale old growth into a transitional forest called an ecotone of black cherry, big tooth aspen, red maple, and white ash. We find ourselves suddenly in a wide meadow under a low sky as a light rain begins to fall. Moving through a waist-high varietal of prairie grass called Big Blue Stem, we notice a couple approaching along a trail in bright puffy jackets. We hear their calls of greeting. There are very few people in the park today, and the woman asks if we are familiar with the area. Intimately, I would say, says Leverett with typical good humor. She asks if she knows where the trees of peace are, a grove of the tallest eastern white pines in New England, so named by Leverett in honor of the Haudenosaunee belief that the white pine is a symbol of peace. Leverett named the individual pines for Native leaders who he's come to know over the years, largely through his first wife, Johnny A. Leverett, who was Cherokee Choctaw and who died in 2003. The tallest among them is the Jake Swamp Pine, which at 175 feet is also the tallest tree in New England. As it becomes apparent just how familiar Leverett is with the area, the woman's eyes widen above her mask until, in a hushed tone, she asks, Are you Robert Leverett? Leverett says yes, and her eyes fill with tears. Susan and her partner Kamal have been camping here the last few nights. The couple from Boston have already paid their respects to the other parts of the woods, but haven't been able to find the trees of peace. Leverett leads us across the field and back into the forest. In all our conversations, Leverett is reticent about the extent of his influence. What he seems most interested in is how the forest affects individual people. There's a spiritual quality to being out here. We walk silently through these woods, and there's a spirit that comes out. My first wife said, "You know, Bob, you're supposed to bring people to the forest. You're supposed to open the door for them. They'll find out thereafter." Leverett has led us to the center of the trees of peace. Susan and Kamal wander among the tall pines, each pausing to place a hand upon a trunk in quiet reverence. The storm that becomes threatening all day never really comes. Leverett leads us up and out, back along the main trail towards the park entrance. Email addresses and invitations are extended, and the couple express their gratitude. It feels like making plans in a church parking lot after a particularly moving Sunday service. This is a familiar scene for Leverett. Over the decades, he has introduced thousands of people to old-growth forests. Ecologists and activists, builders and backpackers, painters and poets, no matter who he's with, Leverett tells me, he wants to understand their perspective, wants to know what they're seeing in the woods. It's as if he's accumulating a fuller, ever-expanding map of our collective relationship to the natural world. Other people are more eloquent in the way they describe the impact of the woodland on the human spirit, he says. I just feel it. Next, we'll read an article from the prologue section titled Changing Lincoln's Mind by Jonathan W. White. In the Civil War, pioneering African Americans met with the president and altered the course of U.S. history. Before dawn on May 13, 1862, Robert Small stealthily took command of a Confederate steamer, the CSS Planter, and steered it out of Charleston Harbor. The 23-year-old, who had worked as a slave aboard the vessel, brought 15 other enslaved people with him, including his wife and their two young children. Smalls knew he might be killed by Confederate guards as he attempted to reach the Union's fleet off the Atlantic coast. Word of Smalls's daring escape quickly spread throughout the North. In a report that merged admiration with racial bigotry, the New York Tribune proclaimed, "This man, though black, is a hero, one of the few history will delight to honor. He has done something for his race and for the world of mankind." On May 30th, Abraham Lincoln signed a law awarding prize money to Smalls for delivering the Planter and its cargo to federal authorities. The influential black minister, Harry McNeil Turner, called Smalls a living example of unquestionable African heroism. In August, Smalls traveled to Washington, D.C., where he met with Lincoln at the White House, perhaps the most consequential meeting Lincoln had with an African-American in the first 2 years of his administration, a crucial period in Lincoln's evolving policy on black citizenship. In the ensuing months and years, arguments by African-Americans who visited Lincoln and the president's willingness to listen would change the course of history. While many historians and biographers have traced the evolution of Lincoln's sentiments about emancipation and equality for African-Americans, few have recognized the central ways that Lincoln's personal interactions with black Americans, from Smalls to Union Army surgeon Anderson Ruffin Abbott, the first black Canadian to graduate from medical school, shaped his thinking. During Smalls' first meeting with Lincoln, he urged the president to allow black men to join the Union Army. Since the beginning of the Civil War, Lincoln had rejected black volunteers, in part because he had no confidence they would fight well. But after meeting Smalls, who had secured his own liberty with such bravery, Lincoln finally embraced the idea of enlisting black troops. And Smalls departed Washington, D.C., bearing a letter from the War Department that authorized the raising of black volunteers in South Carolina. Thanks to Smalls, Lincoln had come to see that arming black men was not a question of sentiment of taste, but one of physical force. The service of black soldiers, in short, was essential to winning the war. Still, after African Americans were allowed to join the Union Army, they didn't receive equal treatment. They served in segregated units, often received subpar weapons and equipment, and were frequently tasked with doing menial labor, such as digging ditches or building fortifications, rather than fighting. Further, federal authorities were determined to underpay black soldiers by designating them as laborers rather than soldiers. They enlisted expecting $13 a month, but received only $10 a month, and unlike white soldiers, had another $3 deducted from their pay as a clothing allowance. A soldier in the famous 54th Massachusetts Infantry wrote directly to Lincoln, "We appeal to you, sir, as the executive of the nation, to have us justly dealt with." They also faced much steeper consequences if captured. Confederate authorities threatened to kill or enslave black soldiers taken alive on the battlefield. On August 10, 1863, Frederick Douglass met with Lincoln and urged him to protect black soldiers from Confederate threats by retaliating in kind and agree without delay upon Confederate prisoners in its hands. He also pressed Lincoln to give black soldiers equal pay. Lincoln considered retaliation a terrible remedy, and he said that if he could get hold of the Confederate soldiers who had been guilty of treating colored soldiers as felons, he could easily retaliate. But he did not wish to punish soldiers for the heinous practice of their political leaders. He didn't wish to hang their soldiers for a crime perpetuated by others. The president also said that the lower pay rate was a temporary but necessary concession to white racism, a way to ease white Northerners into supporting the enlistment of black soldiers. Nevertheless, Lincoln assured Douglass that black soldiers would ultimately receive the same pay. Douglass had his doubts, writing, "While I could not agree with Lincoln on every point, I could respect his humane spirit." In 1864, Lincoln did sign a law equalizing the pay of those black soldiers who had been free before the war. That year, numerous other black advocates went to Lincoln to make direct claims for full citizenship. On March 3rd, two Creoles from New Orleans visited the White House to hand Lincoln a petition calling for a wealthy free black man in their state, which was now under Union control, to have the right to vote. In language that echoed the Declaration of Independence, they told Lincoln they were ready to sacrifice their fortunes and their lives for the country and the Constitution. The petitioners, Arnold Bertineau and Jean-Baptiste Rudinel, noted that free black population of New Orleans had spilled their blood for the Union cause, just as their forebears had done during the War of 1812. "We are men. Treat us as such," they said. They called for those inalienable rights which belong to the citizens, condition of citizens of the greater American public. Petition bore around 1,000 signatures, including those of 28 black veterans who had fought with Andrew Jackson at the Battle of New Orleans in 1815. In response to this petition, Lincoln told his visitors that he must first finish the big job of his hands of crushing the rebellion. And giving African Americans the right to vote became necessary to close the war, he would not hesitate to support it, he said, for he saw no reason why intelligent black men should not vote. But this was not a military question, and he believed it had to be handled by civil authorities in Louisiana. Still, he assured his guests that he would support their request whenever they could show that black suffrage would help restore the Union. A week later, on March 10th, Rudenay and Bertinel submitted a new petition that reframed and expanded their request. Now they asked for the right to vote for all black men in Louisiana, including those who were poor, uneducated, or had been born into bondage. Expanding suffrage in this way, they contended, would give full effect to all the Union feeling in the rebel states in order to secure permanence of the free institutions and loyal governments now organized therein. Such rights especially ought to be given to black men who have vindicated their right to vote by bearing arms. In other words, a crucial way to subdue disloyal sentiment in the South would be to create a new loyal black electorate. Rudenay and Bertinel had crafted a rationale that connected black suffrage to winning the war and sustaining peace. Black voters would help create and maintain pro-Union majorities in the South. Lincoln found the argument compelling and almost immediately adopted their view. On March 13th, he sent a letter to Louisiana's governor-elect, Michael Hahn, suggesting that black men who were intelligent or who fought gallantly in our ranks be granted the franchise. Such voters, Lincoln said, will probably help in some trying time to come to keep the jewel of liberty within the freedom family of freedom. Lincoln's eloquence captured the idea that America wouldn't be truly free country until African Americans were fully integrated into civic life. He had hinted at this idea a few months earlier at Gettysburg, saying, "This nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom in order that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth." Part of that new birth meant counting African Americans among the people. While most white Southerners were fighting to destroy the Republic, Lincoln had become convinced that African Americans would vote to uphold the principles the nation was founded on, and that black political participation would be essential for maintaining Republican government in America during Reconstruction and beyond. On April 11, 1865, Lincoln delivered a speech from the White House balcony publicly calling for educated black men and those who had served as soldiers to be given the right to vote. It had taken him some time to reach this decision. It would be the last speech he ever gave. John Wilkes Booth, listening to the audience below, growled that Lincoln was calling for African-American citizenship. "Now, by God, I'll put him through," Booth said. The actor gunned Lincoln down 3 days later. But Booth was powerless to stop the forces that black petitioners had set in motion during the Civil War. In 1870, the 15th Amendment was ratified, making it illegal for a state to provide citizens of the right to vote on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.